Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome to another episode of Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index, bringing you commentary, analysis, and, let's be honest, a certain amount of idle gossip, speculation, and off-the-cuff theorising about current events in the construction industry. It's Wednesday, the 26th of February. I'm David Taylor, editor of the monthly Construction Index magazine. And as usual, I'm joined today by my colleague Phil Bishop, who's in charge of our daily online news at www.theconstructionindex.co.uk. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, David. How are things?
Not too bad. Windy and wet and a bit cold today, but I'm indoors, so I don't really worry about that.
You're staying healthy and isolated, are you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, staying healthy and isolated is a fantastic segue into our first topic today, because as everybody will know, the top story internationally at the moment is coronavirus. And the construction index is not immune, I'm afraid. We will also be talking about that, because it is beginning to have an effect on the construction industry in the UK in perhaps certain unexpected ways. We all know, because we talked about it previously, about this incredible event back in China at the end of last month when they managed to build a hospital in something like 10 days.
Well, it's more than one, I think, now. And they've sort of taken it for granted and slightly stopped reporting on all the Chinese hospital building magic
Blimey.
That's been going on.
So this is a new normal, is it? Now, you've got no excuse not to build a hospital in anything than a fortnight.
If the money and the personnel are made available, it will happen.
Yeah, if there's a will, there's a way, I suppose. Obviously, that was a big construction story, but since then, the story has mutated. I don't know if the virus
Well, I don't know. We seem to be on the tipping point from scare story to real story. Up until now, obviously, it's an awful thing, but it's the actual stats don't really have seemed to be any worse than your bog-standard flu that kills so many vulnerable and elderly people every winter.
But yes.
If the way it's on every front page this morning, there's clearly more to it. The FTSE 100, I notice, is at a one-year low this week on the back of it all. And the economic damage seems to be, at the moment, mostly confined to, I think, Diageo's in the news and a company that runs restaurants and bars in airports and people in the sort of the FMCG end of things. Building companies, so far, I mean, the statement from Taylor Wimpey this morning was fairly typical, saying, at time of writing, we do not consider that to pose an immediate risk to our business, but we will continue to monitor closely with our supplier base. And that's the issue. It's not that they think all their workforce is going to drop down sick. It's at the moment, they're worried about materials that do come in from China or have componentry from China. And not just China now. It's you know, other parts of the world are getting it hit by it badly as well. But overseas imported materials and components, it's what's going to happen to them.
Yes.
Now, everyone, there's an awful lot suddenly of company financial statements contain the word coronavirus in there now, which they weren't doing obviously a month ago, but even a week ago it was a rarer thing.
But I've doing a bit of groundwork there, I think.
Well, I've only heard from two companies in our sector, very different ends of the sector, who have actually said this is having an impact on us. The first one was JCB, the machinery manufacturer, which has an awful lot of parts suppliers, component suppliers in China. They issued a statement over a week ago now, 17th of February. So the statement was before that, but from the 17th of February, they introduced a shorter working week in their factories instead of 39 hours a week, they went down to 34 hours a week. Now, whether that means that their output is going to be reduced proportionately by whatever that is, 15% or so, I'm not sure, or whether it just means that they'll be doing you know, they can do stuff now, and then when the parts arrive, yes, they can get the machines.
Presumably, they do keep a stock of components to keep them going. But the question, well, I suppose, is how many weeks will it keep them going?
I'm sure they do, but in the modern world, the smarter the manufacturer, the smaller your stock of components. Everything is just, yes, in time these days.
Indeed.
Of course. And so it's a slight sudden weakness in efficient manufacturing that,
yeah,
you know, you need a certain amount of stock. So I don't know how long JCBs are. They reckon that they'll, you know, this is a for the foreseeable future,
yes,
measure.
Yeah.
And the other company that is said something of moderate substance on the subject is Norcross, who make products for bathrooms and kitchens. Johnson Tiles and,
yeah,
is it Triton or Triton Showers are two of their brands. They issued a statement a week ago saying that while the coronavirus had had little short-term impact to date, as they've got enough stock in the UK, they are seeing a slower than anticipated return to full production at their Chinese suppliers. So they're envisaging supply chain disruption to have some impact in the month or two ahead. Now, since those two company statements a week ago, 10 days ago, we've had, seems to me, a broader spread of coronavirus, the reports that, you know, judging by the reports. So I don't think it's going to ease off in perhaps the way that they thought it might have done a fortnight ago.
No.
So it's really watch this space. But I think whatever happens, any company in the next 6 months whose numbers are slightly off previous expectations, I think we're going to hear them use coronavirus as a catch-all excuse, whether real or not, in a sort of a Brexit, the way we've heard Brexit being referenced over the, you know, general Brexit uncertainty.
That's a very cynical view, Phil. You think people are going to hide behind this? They're going to use it to blame their inadequacies on it?
I think that it'll just be a general economic jitters that infect investors and slow things down.
It will probably be a bit of a wake-up call, because a lot of people who may not have realised how dependent we are on Chinese manufacturing will suddenly realise, I had no idea that was made in China, or I had no idea that they were in any way dependent on Chinese production. I haven't heard much from many other sectors. I don't watch other sectors as much as construction.
Well, iPhone have said that their supplies have been disrupted. iPhones are made in China. I mean, as you
they
say,
are.
Everything that's not made in Korea is made in China, it seems.
Yeah.
And Korea is now starting to be affected. I think Samsung has the word that they're having issues in their factories.
Yeah.
But you're right. It not just shows our dependency on China, but more than that, it shows our frailty in the face of things that we, as business frailty in the face of things we cannot control.
Yeah.
Businesses think that they can control all these things, or, you know, things that affect their business. But of course, so much is completely outside their control. They can't lobby against it, or campaign against it, or build walls against it. It's just there, and they have to roll with the impact of it and manage it the best they can.
I mean, of course, we're buying a very expensive nuclear power station from the Chinese, aren't we, at the moment? I don't suppose that's going to be affected, is it? Much more long-term proposition.
Yes, and it depends how long this virus... I mean, I'm quite surprised. It seems like... I don't know how long we've been talking about coronavirus, a month or so, but within a week or two of these first reports coming out, there were reports about how a inoculation against it, the antidote or the whatever it is to the virus, would be found within a couple of weeks. And that doesn't seem to have happened. But then we haven't got a cure for the common cold yet, so who knows?
But I did hear, actually, I don't want to correct you because you're probably right, but I heard something on the radio yesterday about some Chinese professor who has developed some sort of vaccine or inoculation against it. He's tried it on himself twice and he's still alive, apparently. That's all I know. Whether it's actually stopped him contracting the virus, I don't know. But presumably... that must be a top priority for the Chinese, to try and develop some sort of defence against this. But as you said at the opening of the discussion, when you take a step back, you think, or you'd be excused for thinking, are we making a fuss about nothing here? Because as you say, the virus itself, although we don't know much about it, doesn't appear to be any more dangerous than the common cold or the influenza virus. And I know that the influenza virus did kill millions of people in 1918, so it's not without its risks. But I think perhaps the impact is probably short term and stems more from the reaction, the global reaction to the outbreak, rather than to the actual impact of the disease itself.
Yes, I am completely unqualified to comment on whether the world is overreacting, but I said before that unlike many politicians, I've got a lot of faith in experts, and if anyone knows, it's the doctors, and the doctors are saying stay indoors if you've been in a contagious area.
Yes, I suppose what I would say is that, to summarise what I was trying to say just now, is that it doesn't have to be the Black Death in order to wreak havoc worldwide. It can be something relatively innocuous, probably isn't the right word, but it doesn't have to be bubonic plague. It can still wreak enormous havoc.
Yes, the story seems to be globally the chaos rather than the illness.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this pans out. I suppose it's still early days. It could blow over very quickly. I mean, we had the SARS outbreak 10 years ago, something like that. I'd completely forgotten about that, but that was big news at the time.
Well, there's a few of them. There's swine flu and bird flu, and we have these things all the time. Well, not all the time, but periodically.
Yeah. Well, I suppose only time will tell, but at the moment, both you and I assume, are isolating ourselves, so we should be fairly immune, I should think.
I hope so.
Now, we've got should we move on to our second discussion point at the moment?
Yeah, well, the next topic, as regular listeners have probably picked up, we try and pick out three different items from the week's news to chew over. And the big story we had on our website yesterday at Construction Index, with the statement from the Housing Minister, Housing Secretary of State, I should say, Robert Chenwick, that he was going ahead with legislation to set up a body called the New Homes Ombudsman. Yes. Now, this is one of various initiatives that have all come out of, I think it's all vaguely related to the post-Grenfell Tower fire fallout, with all the initiatives that have gone into building regs and the new building safety regulator that's being set up at the Health and Safety Executive. But this New Home Ombudsman is specifically related to arguments between, or disputes between, the house building, new housing developers and their customers, the buyers of new homes. There have been masses and masses of horror stories in the press of people who have bought new homes for hundreds of thousands of pounds and found pretty shoddy workmanship, and they've not always had an easy time getting redress from the building companies. Yeah. And the idea is that this new organisation will have the power to police building quality and resolve disputes between house builders and their customers. I think many people find it's long overdue. Interestingly, the building companies don't seem to have too much of a problem with this intervention by the government into their business.
But it's going to be a mandatory thing, isn't it? I mean, if you're a house builder, you have to be part of the scheme
and pay some money, it will be funded by industry. Yeah. I don't know what the budget is. I don't know how much money, but as we know, house builders are not short of a bob or two.
But does that go for the small house builders? I mean, I know that the industry is dominated by very large companies, but there are still lots and lots of small housing developers in localities around the UK. People who build, three, four houses a year, something like that, are they also going to be required to sign up to this?
I don't know whether there are details. I've certainly not seen details on the financing of it at this stage. I can only imagine, like all these things, it'll either be a percentage of turnover, or it'll be banded. I mean, Persimmon making £1 billion a year profit. Taylor Wimpey this morning announced £850 million profit. These sort of levels, small change, whatever it takes, going to be small change to them. So I don't really think the half a dozen, the person who's developing half a dozen houses, has to get particularly worked up about the financial burdens he's going to create.
It raises several questions in my mind, though, because, yes, we have heard, and we always we always seem to be hearing stories, you know, horror stories about windows falling out and damp and mold and all sorts of defects in brand new houses, which have cost somebody £250,000 or whatever it is. So that's nothing new. But is it unique to house building? We were talking about this the other day, weren't we? And you had an interesting view on this because, yes, we do hear a lot about these defects, but
could there be reasons
why we hear about those?
Yeah, people complain about potholes in the road, of course, and the damage it does to their car or whatever, because their car is a very valuable, for many people, it's the second most expensive thing they'll buy is their car.
Yeah.
And when it gets damaged by a pothole, they get upset about it, naturally. Now, the first most expensive thing most people buy is their apartment, their flat or their house, their property. And if you spent whatever it is, £150,000, £500,000, whatever you're spending on your house, it's an unbelievable commitment, financial commitment. And if there's something wrong with it, you have every right to be upset.
Yes.
Now, of course, the difference with old houses, second-hand houses, is that it's to get a mortgage, you have to have a survey done. And I've lived in my current house for 20-odd years now, and I pulled out my survey, which I had done when I moved in 20 years ago. And I hadn't looked at it for years and years. And it's worth, I can recommend anyone doing it, it's worth looking at things and saying, 20 years ago, I was told that I ought to look at my roof in 20 years' time. I better have another look at it. And things like that. So, we have this professionally compiled document, if we're a house owner, which is a useful reference tool, which is worth looking at every now and then. But if you buy a new house, you don't have that. You assume, you take for granted, with the NHBC warranty and everything else, you take for granted that it's in good nick. It looks in good nick.
It's brand new.
It maybe take a few months living there before you do realise where the voids are or the issues are.
But that raises another question. You mentioned the NHBC warranty. Why do we need an ombudsman to police the industry and raise standards of quality when you've got the NHBC basically providing a quality guarantee for something like 80% of all new homes built in the UK? Why do you need to duplicate?
To my mind, the impending establishment of the New Homes Ombudsman undermines the credibility. We shouldn't just say NHBC. NHBC has an 80% market dominance, but it's not a monopoly. There are other warranty providers. But the warranty system is clearly, I don't want to say failing, but it's imperfect. And the disputes are getting unresolved. What comes to my mind is, I don't know if you remember, in December, Persimmon, who are a big volume house builder, mentioned their £1 billion profits last year. I mean, you may remember they were in the news last year for being overly generous with their executive pay, and the then chief executive, Jeff Fairbairn, walked away with a £75 million bonus, but being unable to defend his luck in public, went away, and the new team, which isn't that new, I mean the new CEO is an old hand, he's from the inside, but they've tried to clear the decks of all the bad publicity at Persimmon, and they commissioned a construction barrister to look into their customer care and building quality and review the company's culture and operations last year, and this report was published in December and published on their website, and it's extraordinary that, I mean, I've never heard or seen a construction company flagellate themselves so thoroughly, comprehensively, and in public, say, yes, we are absolutely crap at building houses, and we admit it, but we're going to do something about it.
Yes.
It emerged during the review that there was one site where not just one, but two separate crews of either employees or subcontractors had gone to remedy issues with cavity barriers. Twice the people had gone and said, yep, we've all fixed it, all the missing cavity barriers have been, we've been put in. And on neither occasion had they been. I mean, to quote the report, the cavity barrier problem is a manifestation of a lack of supervision and inspection of the way in which building work is carried out, both by Persimmon's own labour and its subcontractors. And the chairman of the company admitted on publication of this report, on reading the report, The review found that Persimmon had focused on policies around inspections immediately before and after the sale of a home, rather than those governing build quality inspections. In other words, it was great at selling houses, not good at building them.
Yeah.
It builds around 16,000 homes, houses and apartments a year. So the volume house builders are, by their own admission, or it's certainly, you know, Persimmon is, and it's not unique, it's just the one that's put its hand up and said, right, we're going to do something about it. They tend to build rubbish homes. A lot of mistakes are there. And I hope that the New Homes Ombudsman will crank up the site supervision. I mean, that's what it is. It's lack of quality control on site during the build process.
I wonder, do you think this is a problem that's unique to this sector? Is it something to do with the way how British house building is structured?
No.
Or are there municipal and commercial and industrial buildings equally riddled with defects, but we're just not hearing about them?
Well, I've referenced before in our discussions about the Edinburgh schools issue of 2 or 3 years ago, where fortunately there were no children in the playground. I don't think they were even in the school at the time. But there was a storm and a load of masonry fell off the upper side of one of the walls. And it hadn't been pinned on properly. And that was a top-line national building contractor that had done the work. Hmm. And it was this complete lack of quality control on site. It was typical old bodge, oh, that'll do. That looks about right. And it fell off. And that could have had horrible consequences if the children had been in the playground. And it's related to Grenfell Tower with the cladding and insulation that goes on.
Yes.
It's endemic. And I think the report, which is not getting enough attention, and I know senior industry figures who admit they've not read it, is the, and forgive me, your name escapes me, but the Northern Irish professor chap who did the report into the Scottish schools issue.
Oh, yes.
And lessons that need to be learned. I think the report was done for Edinburgh City Council. And he, the chap himself, is an architect by profession. And this is something that the Scottish architects have been saying as well, is it all comes down to the rise of design and build has put all the power in the hands of the contractor. We don't have clerk of works. We don't have an architect. We don't have a client's representative, or in civil engineering terms, the RE. The client's representative is in charge of making sure the job gets done right. It's now just up to the builder and the contract. And I blame the CIPS for this, Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply. I think they've not got a grip on procurement strategies. And I blame the fact that the building companies have got far more money than the architects and the designers have. And it's the independent middleman has just been something that somehow we said we don't need anymore.
Yeah.
Design and build wins. And design and build is a lot of benefit. I mean, builders do have a lot of expertise in how to build things. And perhaps in the past we've failed to tap into that and things have been overly expensive. But it is time to stop and check and say, what are we missing here? You know, why are these things being allowed to be missed out? The other, well, we haven't talked about the magazine today, David.
We talked last
week about various things in the latest February issue of Construction Index magazine. But apart from your cannabis propaganda, anything else interesting in there?
Loads of good stuff here, but I wanted to talk today about a particular feature which we've got in the current issue of the magazine. You might remember there was a very big contractor once called John Lang Construction. Of course, it's now what was John Lang Construction was bought by Ray O'Rourke, who was a concrete frame contractor.
Lang O'Rourke now.
Yes, that's right. So it's Lang O'Rourke.
He paid a lot of money for him, didn't he? It was a whole pound.
It was a whole pound he paid for them, and money well spent by all accounts.
Seems to have been.
But John Lang Construction, it got into difficulties, serious financial difficulties. I think it was the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff which actually tipped it over the edge, and Ray O'Rourke bought it and boosted his own business and, you know, is now a major contractor in the UK. But John Lang had a fantastic history. The Millennium Stadium, yes, it was his last major project, but it built all sorts of landmark projects, many of which people wouldn't realise were a John Lang project. The Second Severn Crossing. I can't remember. I don't know what the Second Severn Crossing should be called. I always call it the Second Severn Crossing. But that bridge... Pardon?
It's still that to me, I'm afraid.
Yeah, me too. Well, it built that. That was one of its the later ones, back in the sort of mid-1990s. It built the Central London Mosque. Back in the 60s, it built Preston Bus Station, which sounds like a very dull and uninteresting project, but actually is I think it's a listed building now. It's quite an advanced design.
But it's architecturally interesting. Was it hard to build?
I don't know. I don't know how hard it was to build. It was certainly a feather in their cap at the time. Again, that's now Grade 2 listed. All sorts of things. It did a lot of civil engineering work. It built the... it was a major contractor on the M1 and the M6 motorways. Nuclear power stations, you name
it. Sizewell. It built Sizewell, didn't it? Or Sizewell,
yes, it did.
B or 2 or whatever it is.
Yeah. And the Barbican Arts Centre in the centre of London, it built that as well. Anyway, what I'm coming round to saying is that there are tens of thousands of photographs in the John Lang archive. It's the John Lang Foundation? No, the John Lang Charitable John Trust.
I think you're underselling it. I saw the figure 230,000 photos in the archive.
Yeah, yeah.
More than tens of that.
Over
hundreds
half,
of thousands. 230,000 photos.
The figure 10,000...
almost a Kardashian Instagram page.
Sorry?
That's almost a Kardashian Instagram page.
Well, anyway, John Lang, although John Lang Construction became Lang O'Rourke, John Lang itself still continued to exist, not as a contractor, but as a facilities manager and...
Well, it's an investment company, I think.
It's an investment company now, yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it's sitting on this archive of photographs from way back when, basically documenting all these landmark projects. And it's decided that it's got all these photographs clogging up space in its offices somewhere, and it wants them digitised and then made available. And it's teamed up with Historic England, who are in the process of digitising all these photographs. And at the moment, they've just done the first 2,000, which, of course, is a drop in the ocean. And the first batch, I think a total of 10,000 eventually will be made available to the public, I think, by the end of this year. So we've got two or three pages in the magazine about this, and it's just a selection of the photographs. Tiny, tiny little selection, but they're still very interesting. And I think that it does strike a chord with a lot of people in the industry when you sort of open up an archive like this and give people a look inside. And it's a lot of people, obviously, retired people might remember working on these projects back in the day. But I think people who are active in the industry now will also find it interesting because it gives you a snapshot of how things were done in the past, in the relatively recent past as well, and how much things have changed since then. I mean, obviously, one of the things you notice more than anything else is the lack of PPE and an obvious relaxed...
Well, they're a social record, aren't they?
Yes, exactly. It's a fascinating record. And I think that there must be untold John Lang Charitable Trust style archives out there.
Well,
and indeed we have had a hint that that is the case. Take up the story, Phil. Tell us about it.
Well, let me tell you. We reported the Historic England John Lang initiative online in January, and on the back of that, I got a phone call from a chap called, or an email initially from a chap called John Keenan down in Somerset, who is the curator of something I'd not heard of until this time: the Construction Industry Resource Centre Archive, or Circa, if we can abbreviate it to that. And it sounds like a terribly old organisation, but it's actually only started up in the 90s. Now, this man, Keenan, was a Chartered Institute of Building man involved with the British Standards Institution in the mid-90s. And he got a commission to do some digging into what documents were used in the UK construction industry as resources. This is all a prelude to a new BSI guide, construction standards manual. And anyway, he dug out, along with colleagues at the BSI, 8,800 documents that were relevant to people who were building things, whether the standard documents, codes of practice, whatever, whatever. And that was the starting point, the creation of a National Archive for Construction, which Mr. Keenan has found himself in charge of ever since, past, 25 years or so. Anyway, this archive soon...
It's not just documents, is it? It's not just documents and photographs.
Let me tell you what the story, as I understand it. It came into about at the time when an awful lot of companies were, well, one, companies were disappearing, and two, companies were going paperless. They decided they didn't need files. I mean, you must have worked in companies that said, what have you got that filing room for at the back of the office? We don't need anything in files anymore. No one uses paper. And I've been guilty myself in publications I've worked for of being forced to throw out things which, tear in my eye, that I thought, this is awful, we're throwing this stuff away. It must have a value somehow. But no, we've all gone paperless. Anyway, a lot of people turned to John Keenan and the Construction Industry Archive and said, look, we've got all this paper, take it. And this included, after Wimpey and Tarmac, George Wimpey and Tarmac did their asset swap, Wimpey gave Tarmac its construction business and Tarmac gave Wimpey its house building interest in the mid-late 90s, whenever it was. George Wimpey's archive, much the same as John Lang's, I imagine, went to the Construction Industry Resource Centre archive, to Circa. And it didn't just include paperwork and photos, it included the contents of the trophy cabinet of cups that it had won, and the boardroom table, a huge gate, 25-foot boardroom table, I'm told, is there. And then the Property Services Agency, when that was privatised for the millennium, its library was suddenly surplus to requirement. Property Services Agency was the government's building works division. So massive documents there. The upshot is that there's an awful lot of stuff in this archive, and it's housed in an old mill building near Stroud, in a place called Dudbridge, Kimmins Mill. It's a listed building. It stands in what is today the car park of a Sainsbury's supermarket.
And it's owned by Sainsbury's, I understand.
It's owned by Sainsbury's.
Is that right?
Yeah. And Sainsbury's, for the best part of 20 years, has been charging them a peppercorn rent until end of 2017. John Keenan gets a notice of eviction from Sainsbury's saying that, and I'm not quite sure whether it's because the building was in a disrepair and Sainsbury's felt, you know, that we need to repair this building, otherwise we're going to be liable for it, or what the motivation was. But Sainsbury's basically said, look, sorry, we need you out. But, you know, we'll give you till the end of the year, or I think in 6 months, to clear out. Problem is, there are miles and miles of shelving of documents and boxes. There was the old Brick Development Association brick library, which represents a 40-foot container load of bricks, every different type of brick that's been used in the country, all sorts of stuff. And John Keenan and his cadre of you know, part-time volunteers giving up their weekends or time that they could to try and get stuff out by hand and find places to store it and places to take it on. It was a monumental challenge, which at the end of the day they were, you know, they got out what they could when they could.
How long did they have to get out?
Well, there's initial 6 months. I mean, I spoke to Sainsbury's about this, and they were, you know, they don't sound like the heavy-handed bad guys. They say that, you know, they gave them 6 months. When that deadline was missed, they gave them another 3 months, which at that time took it to January 2019. But as far as Sainsbury's saying, that the building's a safety hazard, the floors are rotting, it's all got beetles and dry rot and woodworm and whatever, and it's all overloaded with this masses and masses of archive material. So the building is, you know, Sainsbury's got the key to the building, and they're giving John Keenan and his team ad hoc access when the Sainsbury's property team and the structural engineers are there on hand to ensure safety, when they can organise it. So they had another couple of weeks last month, and they got out another, I don't know, 20 tons or something. But John Keenan says he's desperate for more time. He wants to get this stuff out. He's desperate for more time. But the
more time, more space as well. I mean, where's he going to put all this stuff?
Well, I said, you know, what's the future for the archive? And I think it's all being broken up. He's finding different places for different bits of it. And it's not just Construction Archive. I think there's a lot of local history societies have found him a useful storage ground as well.
Okay.
So there's local history stuff, but it's the construction stuff that I'm interested in. And I think the National Archives in Kiev put their hands up for something. I mean, Taylor Wimpey have taken back, I think, some of the Wimpey stuff. University of Warwick's Modern Record Centre. I don't know if they're taking stuff or expressed interest in stuff, but parts of it are going in all different directions. It all seems terribly ad hoc. I'm not even sure how thoroughly catalogued all the material that's in there. I haven't been to Kimmins Mill. I would have loved to have gone there a couple of years ago before the decant started, but the decant, it sounds to me, I don't know if it's a quarter done or two-thirds done, but it is by no means fully done. There's masses still there. And it's sort of so sad that we haven't got... I mean, the London Transport Museum is a well-funded, well-resourced thing by, you know, Transport for London, London Underground, is a beautiful day out. It's a shame that we haven't got a British Construction Museum.
Oh, well, I agree.
And not just of the archives and the photos, but you think of all the defunct construction machinery manufacturers that we used to have. Whether it's the Ruston Bucyrus or NCK or all the different manufacturers that were pioneers in the early days. We've got JCB still here, a British brand, and maybe he's the man we should be tapping up to say, come on, let's have a for all construction machinery and construction products and construction ingenuity. Let's get it going. I don't want to go on.
Well, when you consider that somewhere up in the Lake District there's a National Pencil Museum, I think the justification for a National Construction Museum is very easy to make.
Well, I believe, I've not been to the Pencil Museum, but I believe it's not exactly large. And I have higher aspirations for a construction museum. I'm thinking more of the London Transport Museum scope of operation. I mean, let's go for it. But as I was going to say, I don't want to put my hand up to be in any way responsible except to spread the message, lest I end up like John Keenan with...
Yes, biting off more than you can chew.
finding myself with loads and loads and loads, more material than I can carry, and having to move it at short notice. David, good spending our usual half hour or so chatting over the week's news on reconstruction. Thank you, anybody and everybody who's listening to us once again. We are available from all your usual podcast outlets if you care to register to make sure you don't miss us any week. And leave us a review wherever you can leave us a review, and score us marks out of however many marks they score us out of. But this is for this week is me, Phil Bishop, and my friend
and me, David Taylor.
saying goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can find the latest issue of the Construction Index magazine in WH Smith, an independent newsagent UK-wide. Use our store locator to find your nearest stockist today at theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine.